All right, thank you. I'll try to wrap this up. This was a great session, and then we can all have some lunch. So as mentioned, I'm Wendy Patterson, New York State Department of Health, and listed below are some of my co-authors, which actually most of them are here today. So each year in New York State, about 20% of newly diagnosed persons with HIV are concurrently diagnosed with AIDS. AIDS is the name of the stage-free HIV. So stage one HIV is when you have the initial symptoms that feel like the flu. And then stage two, you're asymptomatic. And stage three is when you start really having those immunocompromised infections and your inability to fight off infection. So that indicates that you've been diagnosed or that you've been infected years before you've actually been diagnosed. When someone is initially diagnosed with HIV at that point where they've reached the immunocompromised stage, it makes it a lot harder to treat them. They have high viral loads, they have less healthy status, they have a harder time fighting infections, and that also increases their short-term mortality than if they were actually diagnosed earlier in the infection. In 2014, New York State Governor announced a plan to end AIDS in New York State. Three-point plan was to reduce the number of new infections of HIV, identify persons who continually remain undiagnosed and link them to care, and to link and retain people in care who are already diagnosed with HIV. Oops. So two objectives of our study was to identify these people who are concurrently diagnosed with HIV and AIDS and describe the characteristics of these persons. By identifying these characteristics, these will be potential characteristics of people who still remain undiagnosed in the population in which testing could be targeted. It's important to identify these earlier missed opportunities of diagnosis to enable people to begin treatment earlier and prevent the spread of the disease. In New York State, we've collected data in our HIV surveillance system. This contains data in New York State as a whole, which includes New York City data. These are people newly diagnosed in New York State, but also people who have been diagnosed elsewhere and are currently living in New York State and receiving treatment in New York State. In 2014, in New York State, there are 3,434 people newly diagnosed with HIV. This group was split into two groups, those who were concurrently diagnosed with AIDS and those who are not. These two groups are compared in terms of sex assigned at birth, age of diagnosis, race, ethnicity, and the transmission risk group. Based on this group, we split this existing group into three more groups to create regression models. One group was the men who have sex with men. The second group was males who had no indication of sexual contact with males. And the last group was females. Within these groups, we included age of diagnosis and race ethnicity as variables in the model. This is our result of the 3,434 people who were newly diagnosed in 2014. About 80% were male, 60% had transmission risk group of MSM, 40% were non-black Hispanic, and 30% were Hispanic. At this point, the concurrent and non-concurrent groups look pretty similar. However, when we look at age, those who were concurrently diagnosed with HIV and AIDS were older compared to those who were not concurrently diagnosed. The average age of the currently diagnosed people was 42 years old. The non-concurrent was only 35 years old. So in looking at the cells, you can see 40% of the population was under the age of 40 for those concurrently diagnosed, and 40% were under the age of 30 for those not concurrently diagnosed. Also, in comparing concurrent and non-concurrent, the percent MSM was lower in the concurrent group, and you can see that the percent of heterosexual and unknown risk was higher in the concurrent group. So comparing those three risk groups that I talked about earlier, we had 60% of our population in the MSM risk group. The percent concurrency within the three groups, though, was actually different in the males. Non-MSM risk group had the highest percent of concurrently diagnosed compared to those in the female risk group and those in the MSM risk group. Again, comparing those three groups across race ethnicity, the other race ethnicity group had the highest percent of concurrently diagnosed cases. However, in the females group, the non-Hispanic white was similarly as high. When you focus on just the MSM risk group, which is the blue group, you will notice that there's not much difference between the race and ethnicity. Similarly, by diagnosis, age of diagnosis, in the MSM age group, the highest rate of concurrency was in the 60-plus age group, but it was lower in the other two groups. In the male non-MSM age group, it was 40 to 49 with the highest rate of concurrency, and 50 to 59 for females. Here's the three models that we had conducted. And you can see that the odds ratio increases with age for the MSM. It also increases with age in the males non-MSM and also in the females. However, in those two groups, when you get to the 60-plus age group, you'll notice that the odds ratio start to decrease. The only race ethnicity group that was significant in any of the three models was Hispanic, and that was only in the female model. With the male non-MSM model, we noticed that 60% of the cases identified unknown as their risk transmission group. So we decided to take that group and split it further into two more models. We looked at the unknown risk and then the other risk categories. In the other risk, about 74% were in the heterosexual context. In the unknown risk model, we saw the same pattern of significance with age. However, when we got to the other race, that was significant, and that had not been shown before. In the other risk group, we found that the 30 to 39-year-olds was no longer significant in the model, and none of the race ethnicities were significant either. Age was the most significant predictor across all the three models, and this indicated years of missed opportunities for HIV testing. Although our methodology is slightly different from previous research, they still found the same conclusion that age is the biggest predictor. Our research was slightly different in that we split risk into three models, and previous research would always put risk as a variable into the model. We also had a shorter time frame of concurrency. We used 30 days between the HIV and AIDS diagnosis. Other studies had used 60 days. And we also put in more discrete age groups to see if we could see a difference in age. A lot of the studies only looked at 30 and under and 30 and over, so we put in those 10-year intervals to really drill in onto the age. We found that males non-MSM had a higher rate of concurrency than the MSM group and the females, and they should be targeted as they're a non-traditional group that's usually targeted for testing. One study actually found that Asian Pacific Islander had increased risks, so we tried to look at that in our study, and we had a small sample, and it just wasn't significant. However, we did find the Hispanic significant in the female group, which hadn't been reported in other studies. Some of the limitations of this study is that we only had 1 year of data, that the study was a statewide study, so we lumped together New York City and upstate, and normally that's something that we might split out because there are differences. The counts could also be underestimated because there's certain facilities that are excluded from reporting, so that's always a concern we have. Future studies could include multiple years of data, a rural or urban indicator, or an upstate downstate indicator in our case, country of birth indicator, as well as the provider type or facility type of diagnosis as well, such as an emergency room or a clinic. The New York State law currently requires providers to offer all testing HIV testing to all patients age 13 and over. This allows for an opportunity for consistent testing throughout the lifespan and also for the testing of individuals of risk groups that aren't normally targeted for testing. This is the opportunity to identify the infection earlier and to treat before the symptoms occur. This law supports one of the main goals of the Ending the Epidemic Initiative in New York State, which is the opportunity to identify persons with HIV who are currently undiagnosed. Testing initiatives should be directed at all age groups. However, based on these studies, older age groups should be targeted. Testing throughout the life course should be framed as an opportunity to diagnose HIV earlier and to get on treatment before symptoms actually begin. Public health initiatives that facilitate early diagnosis of HIV may reduce HIV-related mortality and unknown transmission of the virus by giving the people the opportunity to initiate care and begin treatment earlier. These are the references of some of the studies I talked about earlier, and that is my contact information.
All right, well, thanks, everybody. This was an excellent group of presentations. So now we are open for questions, and I'm going to take the moderator's prerogative here. So, Scott, I think you guys did an excellent project there trying to understand the epidemiology. You said you didn't have a lot of resources, but you used them to the best of your ability. I was just curious about, since you have found the association with incarceration, kind of what your relationship is with jails and prisons in terms of STD testing, since that seems like a low-hanging fruit type of situation. So,
I'll be quite honest. So I moved to Utah about a year ago, and I'm still learning about some of these relationships. And I would say that it's still progressing. So we're having a lot of active talks about HIV and Hep C testing, but I would say that there's still work to do, and still we're still working on that.
Great. Anybody else have questions? Just come up to the mic.
Hi, my name is Jarrell, and I'm from Clark County in Southwest Washington, and my question is for Utah. I will second her. That was a very innovative study and a wonderful use of a combination of communicable disease data and BRFUS data. My question is just a clarifying one. Was your study only on 2015?
No. So.
Wait, let me... Yes, it was.
Okay, so based on that, I have a question.
Sure.
So you guys did a great job of comparing your cases from 2015 to BRFUS data from 2015, but showed a dramatic trend from like 2012 to 2015. So your odds ratios and your results are great for 2015, and say methamphetamine came through very, very strongly. Do you think methamphetamine use also describes the trend going back?
So I do think that we are seeing increased methamphetamine use in Utah. Our opioid use in general is skyrocketing, and it's something that is definitely on everybody's mind, and everybody's trying to think of how to address this in the state of Utah. So I would say it's partially accountable for that. I think it would be great if we could show more of a trend. Obviously, how we were getting the case information was at the clinic when or in the disease investigation process. So it would be pretty labor intensive to do this kind of more, trend analysis. But I think it would be useful if we could look at that. So does that answer the question?
It does. Thank
okay.
You.
Yeah.
I actually have a question for Sarah. With the HIV and syphilis increases and all of the syphilis increases we've been talking about, there's a national shortage of bicillin. Can you speak to how that likely is going to affect case counts and comorbidities?
Well, I think anytime you have difficulty procuring treatment and have to refer somebody to somewhere else to get treated, or have a delay in treatment because you're waiting to get the treatment, that's not good. So clearly that's not good. However, just my understanding of the current situation as bicillin is that the company has, they are making, the stock has been replenished. So even by the end of the year, they'll get back up to their normal sources, but that their drug does exist in the country. And so what we're advising is that health departments really take an inventory of where they're at, try and be proactive and anticipate where they think they're getting low, and because you can order that, get early deliveries from the company through your normal mechanisms. So we're hopefully that will be, but this is an ongoing issue with multiple drugs, as you've heard about. So I'm hoping we don't have it again, but I'm hoping that this current problem is on the path to being solved.
I had a question for Madison. I was wondering if you looked at all at expedited partner therapy because I know you talked about increasing that afterwards, but I didn't know if you looked at it in your study at all.
Yeah, so actually EPT data is only recorded kind of through that interview process, and since we only interview a small subset, actually the MSM subset of our chlamydia cases, we really didn't have a whole lot of local level data on EPT, just because that would be the chlamydia cases would be the big people who would be getting EPT. So that's actually a big part of the EPT program that we're putting into place now. We're doing some baseline data collection where we're actually going to go through and interview all of our chlamydia cases that come in, as well as the gonorrhea ones that are already being interviewed, and ask very specific questions about if they were offered EPT, and then look at that based on where they went in the community, what provider they went to, so that we can do specialized provider outreach to really improve EPT recommendation. Because, yeah, you're right, that's huge among the heterosexual population in the community.
Hi, Matt from Utah. I have a question for Wendy. When you were looking at the concurrent within 30 days diagnosis, if there was a delay in reporting, or if the patient didn't have some indication of AIDS within those 30 days, did you exclude them or include them, or did they fall into the non-AIDS group?
Okay, so it was 2014 data, so hopefully it was all reported by then. And if they weren't diagnosed within 30 days and they were diagnosed within a year, that would be the late HIV, they were in the non-concurrent group. So concurrent was just the 30 days.
Okay. Yeah, because we, you know, wondering how far out to go with the concurrent, 30 days, 6 months, sometimes just looking at a year. So I was curious. So you recommend the 30 days is definitely.
That's what we use. Okay. I noticed another state had used 60 days. When I was looking through the studies, it kind of seems like everybody hovered around 30, 60 days.
30 to 60. Great.
Yeah.
I have a question for Mark. We're spreading out the questions. I was just wondering if there was any correlation between what patients self-reported in their interviews to the HIV surveillance database in terms of viral load or CD4s to kind of validate whether they really were in care.
Sure, that's a great question. One thing we did find is that self-report was very consistent with what we found in HIV surveillance matching. So we didn't find a whole lot of patients that reported being HIV negative that were HIV positive in the surveillance registry. In fact, we found a number of people who self-reported being HIV positive that were not present in the registry. Unfortunately, we don't have CD4 and viral load data pulled out of the HIV surveillance registry for analysis in this project, but that would be an incredible validation, and I think that could be done at the local level by many of our jurisdictions. So what a great idea. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Chiu Kim, and I'm from South Korea in Samsung Medical Center. I am internal medicine doctor, and my English skills are not so good, so there is possibility of mispresentation content, but I want to ask to Gerard. So how can you differentiate the reinfection patient from the recurred or treatment failure patient from reinfection patient?
That's a good question. We chose cases for reinfections. Let's see. So our repeat cases had appropriate treatment, and there was not a suspicion of treatment failure in those cases. It appeared from the information that we had in our surveillance system that it was a successful treatment, and another infection occurred later. So the combination of appropriate therapy and apparent response to the therapy was what we used as an indicator.
My question is for Jared as well. Did you guys look at sexual preference as one of the indicators for a repeat infection?
We did. Unfortunately, with our small numbers, we didn't see a difference with persons who had repeat infection and persons with just one infection by MSM status, so persons who had reported sex with males. So at the amount of cases we had with reinfections were not different enough with our persons who had only one syphilis case to show a difference in MSM status.
Hi, my question is for Sarah. I'm Zach from Cook County. I was just curious if you have looked at or if you were planning to look at co-infection of syphilis and HIV and onset of neurosyphilis symptoms.
I'm trying to think if I can do that.
As you probably know, the way we conduct surveillance for neurosyphilis is not great. we have a fellow who's done an analysis looking at reporting of neurosyphilis, and I think it's really underreporting at least the people who are being treated for neurosyphilis, or because the case definition requires having a lumbar puncture and certain combination of results, and we know that a lot of people are being treated empirically, so I think there's a lot that's not even to mention the issues with ocular syphilis, which can have a negative LP. So there's no way to currently even collect data on ocular syphilis cases, which is a big concern now. So I think that's a really great question. And in some supplemental studies that we will be able to look at HIV status
and neuro symptoms and ocular symptoms, so we will be able to look at that, but I don't, and I theoretically could in the case report data, but having cases that report both HIV status and then among those with neurosyphilis is probably a really low number, and I wouldn't really, probably not reliable, something I would hang my hat on.
And Sarah's not mentioning that is one of the reasons we're updating the position statement for syphilis.
So I have a question for Araceli. I found the data that you used was just fascinating. It's a data set that we often, the type of data we don't often think about in public health. Were you guys able to assess any sort of consumer reports of problems accessing condoms? I'm thinking about the communities where most of the condoms are locked up, and you know, is that 17-year-old going to be embarrassed and not going up to the pharmacist saying, "Oh, can I have some condoms?"
So because we are updating the analysis to now use 2016 STD data, we are going to start moving forward whenever we are interviewing cases to ask them very specifically if what their condom retail purchasing patterns are. But yes, absolutely. I think the communities that sort of pop up on the STD maps for having high STDs are also tend to be like lower income, high minority communities that have access problems in general. But I also, there is a move to try to figure out how we can decrease embarrassment, especially among certain group. There's a lot of debate within our group about whether we can get the MSM population back onto condoms because of PrEP. But for women, young adults, teenagers, and non-MSM populations, we have a more viable strategy to try to remarket condoms and to make them more available or to hand them out for free. Again, like we used to do pre-HIV, when it was the scare was really high, when the fear about HIV was really high. So, but I think that requires more study, and there's some other data sets we can probably use for that.
Great. Well, let's have another round of applause for an excellent session. Thank you.